At faculty meeting on Sunday, I proposed that sometime this week we discuss the issue, the main issue brought up in the title of a publication by Arthur Okun, O-K-U-N, member of the Brookings Institution, called Equality and Efficiency, the Great Trade-Off. My name is Dale Hayworth, and I'm an art historian and have no business talking about this, which does not mean I'm not interested. The issue is strong and powerful and underlies a great deal of the situation in which we find our country and society today. Al Pitcher is here because he has spent a, well, because I asked him once, but he has also spent a substantial part of his life wrestling with, concerned with problems similar to those posed by the author of this book. Our format will simply be a throwing out of a few sentences and ideas, which I'll identify from having underlined them in the book, and then have you engage in some conversation about the notion. I wrote this on the board because twice today I heard people talking about it. Once when Carol introduced the statement at Vespers, and I had a feeling that it was not the same subject we were talking about. So, is anybody here under false pretenses and would like to leave? Actually, what I heard was very interesting. What I heard was the discussion will be on quality and efficiency. And I got thinking, well, they left the E off. But that, of course, will be one of the key issues, and perhaps, without giving it away, it's possible to discover in this publication that quality is not an issue that Okun addresses himself to. So, let me read a couple of statements. He has his book divided into four chapters, the first on rights and dollars. He identifies rights with, among others, the following feature. In sharp contrast with economic assets, an obvious feature of rights is that they are acquired and exercised without any monetary charge. Because citizens do not normally have to pay a price for using their rights, they lack the usual incentive to economize in exercising them. The word incentive is one that he strongly works over. I might read the first paragraph of that chapter. American society proclaims the worth of every human being. All citizens are guaranteed equal justice and equal political rights. Everyone has a pledge of speedy response from the fire department and access to national monuments. As American citizens, we're all members of the same club. Yet at the same time, our institutions say, find a job or go hungry, succeed or suffer. They prod us to get ahead of our neighbors economically after telling us to stay in line socially. They award prizes that allow the big winners to feed their pets better than the losers can feed their children. Such is the double standard of a capitalist democracy. Professing and pursuing an egalitarian political and social system and simultaneously generating gaping disparities in economic well-being. This mixture of equality and inequality sometimes smacks of inconsistency and even insincerity. Yet I believe that in many cases, the institutional arrangements represent uneasy compromises rather than fundamental inconsistencies. The contrast among American families in living standards and in material wealth reflect a system of rewards and penalties that is intended to encourage effort and channel it into socially productive activity. To the extent that the system succeeds, it generates an efficient economy. But that pursuit of efficiency necessarily creates inequalities, and hence society faces the big trade-off between efficiency and equality. I think it would be more effective if some of these hit sharp and direct at any moment for you simply to jump in and shout and cheer and say that's neat, or whatever the vice versa is. Anybody familiar with Herbert Spencer?
Yes.
Hey, okay, James.
The evolutionist man.
In the
sort of thing.
Latter part of the last century.
Yeah. He had a vast number of fanatical followers in this country years ago. They mostly have faded now.
Does this sound like him? This is a quote. It sounds like him. It's a quote, but I want to make sure that you identify this maybe with Spencer's position. The command, if any would not work, neither should he eat, is simply a Christian enunciation of that universal law of nature under which life has reached its present height, the law that a creature not energetic enough to maintain itself must die.
That's
Spencer?
That's Spencer, yeah.
Okay. He talks then, after he identifies some characteristics of rights, including the one I began with, he talks then about transgressions of dollars on rights. One that he emphasizes is that money buys legal services that can obtain preferred treatment before the law. He's not here talking specifically about bribery or payments under the table or influences of an illegal kind. He's simply saying here that before the law, those with more money have the opportunity to buy better help. And therefore, dollars have transgressed into the law. The law states we all have equal opportunities before the courts. So he recognizes.
That's really true in our tax system.
Our tax system? You want to elaborate on this, Dave?
Yes, the wealth can buy the best tax services, and even though the law is supposed to apply equally, it's too complex for a non-specialist to understand. And therefore, the wealthy, not because they are given any preferential treatment, but simply because they can afford the specialist, end up paying a lower tax.
Is there a... Can we get around this? Can IRS develop a form that poor me can understand?
Absolutely.
If you're poor, you can understand it, but it's relatively simple. I mean, the short form is so simple.
I go one notch above.
Actually, I think that a lot of it's understandable, but we all have a built-in inferiority feeling when we handle those forms. Mm-hmm. I make out my own tax, and they whack me down now and then. Of course, I have a very simple life. I'm not a businessman. I'm a teacher. But I still ride the loopholes just short of illegality. So forth.
I wonder if you're above the average in understanding where the loophole is.
I play games with friends of mine who are accountants. Mm-hmm. They ask me, have you claimed this? And I say, yes. It's very rare that they catch me on one that I haven't claimed. Every once in a while, they do. But I know them pretty well. And I have a great amount of pride in not turning it over to someone. Because after all, mine is not a complex business proposition. I'm as Mark Twain said in Huckleberry Finn, when there was this big sow on the Arkansas street with her little pigs sucking away there in the middle of the street, she was contented as a man who's on salary. Well, I'm on salary.
Nevertheless, I think the situation exists when Ronald Reagan in California, with his income, pays no state or federal income tax. I think it was it state only. Yeah, with his income, because he has the deductions and knows how to make them and the loopholes, whatever else, and the other half million middle income people support both ends of the spectrum, those on welfare and the wealthy. I think there's a lot of inequality, no matter how just our tax laws may appear to be. What did Nixon not pay?
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree with that characterization rather than the prior characterization that the tax laws were just, but it was just a matter of special knowledge. I think it's fairly clear from a reading of the code that most of the deductions are not applicable to normal incomes. So most of the deductions are there for one reason or another. And some of it is social policy, some of it is special treatment. But I don't think that the key is knowledge so much. If you have the money, then you can do the kinds of things that get the deductions that your lawyer or your accountant tells you. I have a pretty good knowledge of the code, but it doesn't do me that much good because what can I do? It takes a lot of money to get the deductions.
Well, if we can agree that we happen to have focused on tax law, here's an area that we've been messing with for 45 years. A lot of time and attention affects everybody, yet it really hasn't come out with anything we can call fair. So here's a case where the government is trying to do something on a fair and equitable basis and gets pulled and tugged out of all proportions. So that you might extrapolate from there and say, hey, the more the government gets involved trying to solve these problems fairly, the more unfair and distorted it gets. If you go back to the original premise, maybe government should set the ground rules of equality and quit there and not try to legislate equality into everything. I think that the original premise that, hey, we should have equality, but that it only functions up to a point, I think is a good observation, but I'm certainly in agreement with it, because once you get past setting the ground rules of equality, you really get danger of people then expecting equality all the way up the line, and you immediately lose incentive.
We should not expect equality?
I'm saying you should expect equality only on the ground rules. You should not be denied the opportunity to apply for a job because of your race, creed, or color. So the government sets the ground rules. But beyond that, your qualifications and your ability should be a matter of energy and intelligence and ability to produce, if you will.
Well, I agree with you.
Well, Okun discusses this, but he identifies, therefore, this society which would establish the ground rules, and from there it's up to everybody else. He said, that's fine. The analogy he uses is that it's a race, and he says that not everybody starts at ground zero in this race, in terms of ability, in terms of capacity to learn, in terms of economic viability to take advantage of situations, so that even though the job is there, it's not an equal race, it's not a fair race, because we all don't start from the starting point.
His meaning of equality there then is really money, income, material, sharing in a material,
the things you buy.
Expendable income.
Okay.
Well, what is his argument with people of different ability being compensated differently? Is he arguing that this is a basic injustice? He's saying that your quote that everybody doesn't start from the same basis because of, say, native ability.
Yeah.
Now, what would he have as an alternative? That everyone gets the same expendable income regardless of their native ability, and presumably their native ability somehow influences their ability to produce whatever it is they're trying to produce.
As I recall, he establishes a floor at which everyone should be, in terms of we've now got a national poverty line, and he establishes a similar floor, not debating where it is so much. And from then on, he does work very hard to establishing the efficiency of the system must be maintained, and from that point on, inequalities will in fact exist. Is this fair, Al?
Yeah, well, you've got two principles, really, efficiency and equality. That's the trade-off. That is, he wants to maintain both. And you can't maintain both without giving in one to the other. And the question is, at what place do you make your trade-off? So that some efficiency would sacrifice for equality, and he sacrificed some equality for efficiency. So when you say, will a fellow who expends more effort get more money, he would say yes. But if he gets more money because his father happened to be a certain kind of person with certain advantages, and he quotes the statistics about how many people go to school if you come out of a certain kind of a family as over against another kind of a family, which means you start out differently, and it's not a matter of effort, then he's got all kinds of problems with rewarding what isn't effort.
But he's basically picking a case, as we did with the IRS, and say, hey, if the inheritance tax, which tries to readjust income, is wrong, then we should finagle it. But
he would say we ought to have a much stiffer inheritance tax,
okay,
and we ought to have a much different capital gains tax. And those are two things that he thinks we can get some equality without affecting efficiency, which is the capacity of our system for growth. As
is he really arguing the capital gains taxes should be increased to increase the efficiency?
No, he argues that it won't decrease the efficiency.
Because the normal argument on capital gains is the other way.
That's right.
You have to have less capital gains to get more capital risk for more capital accumulation for more productive capacity.
And as an economist, he argues that that's not so. He recognized that the usual argument is that you need to have the capital gains in order to get the investment. And then he doesn't go into detail, but one could, that most investment is internal now in corporations, and it doesn't come from the stock market and that sort of thing. His point is, though, that when you get a trade-off where you don't affect efficiency, then his principle, or you don't affect it much, then his principle is equality. In other words, he comes out of a philosophical, it's not a religious base, at least there's no mention of it, a philosophical base in which equality is something that's a kind of right. It's a matter of respect, of dignity of the individual, and that's very important for him. I don't know what the ground for it is, but he just asserts it.
How many economists agree to that thesis to begin with, that you can't have efficiency and equality? This is new to me. I have difficulty accepting it without having it explained a little further to me. It's entirely new to me.
Well, if you taxed away everybody's income and made everybody absolutely equal, then the question is whether people would work so hard to get the same income that they could work for not working so hard and not going through all the pain of professional education and 15 years of college education to be a professor and all that kind of stuff. If you got the same income.
That situation exists.
Yeah,
today, I'll make a generalization, which isn't exactly true, but almost true. Today, we really have a national commitment that no one will starve to death in this country. Now, there are counties where food stamps aren't working and so forth, but generally we have a commitment that nobody starves to death. And then in addition, we have a system of unemployment compensation where not only do you not starve to death, you probably get paid for not working. Now here we have an inefficiency because the most efficient thing would be those that were not able or not interested in working would starve to death and would die of starvation. Now that's a trade-off between efficiency and equality. Equality is, we say, everyone's going to eat. Efficiency would be those that can't produce die. Now that's unchristian and unthinkable, and I'm not proposing it. But that's the extreme case of the trade-off. But really, you might say we may have gone too far. I use the example, there are 12% of the construction workers in the Minneapolis where I happen to live who are unemployed. And in conversations like this, I say, when has somebody knocked on your door and said, I'm an unemployed carpenter or bricklayer, have you any handyman work you want done? I'd be happy to work for $5 an hour. There does not the incentive to go out and look for handyman work by unemployed construction workers because they're not starving to death. So that we already have said, hey, people are going to eat, and we've already said we're even going to compensate them for not working. And this is inefficient. It's inefficient because the people are not being productive.
Okay, now this is what I was wondering. What does efficiency refer to here? I was thinking that we were talking about efficiency of production, but that's not the case, huh?
We're talking about efficiency of utilizing the total resources of the economy. Presumably, if the unemployed carpenters were building houses free for the poor people that didn't have a house, it would be more efficient.
A shorthand way of referring to it, I think, with GNP. That is, I think you could have a notion of efficiency in which you just let people starve to death, and they might be very inefficient in terms of the total system, but maybe they put in more than they took out of it. But if they put in more than they took out of it, certainly they'd increase the GNP. So I think roughly you could say it's how do we get the greatest GNP? And if by having equality, by taking income from people, by reducing the incentives to do what is necessary to create and to produce, by taking away those incentives, you by having equality, you take away those incentives, then you're going to decrease your GNP. And so he says you've got to have a trade-off here. The question is, where do you put that trade-off? I think you're right. That is, if you just had efficiency, you wouldn't worry about people at all. You would let the system take care of it.
Might be helpful to understand his position if you read or summarize that short conclusion.
At the very end?
Yes.
One thing ought to be made clear, I think we're probably less interested in discussing Oaken than we are in discussing the issues. So I'm not interested in throwing rocks at him, but here is part of his conclusion. I have stressed particularly the urgency of assisting the bottom fifth on the income scale and helping them into the mainstream of our affluent society. He, by the way, seems not to question any place, at least not in this publication, the desirability of an affluent society. He says it's the economic deprivation that blocks access to first homes, first cars, and college slots for solid students. That's what troubles me deeply. In part, my optimism reflects my standards of successful equalization. I would not be greatly exercised about unequal prizes won in the marketplace if they merely determined who could buy beachfront condominiums, second cars, and college slots for children in the bottom core of the town. It's the economic deprivation that he's concerned about for those who can't buy the first homes, the first cars, and can't get into college even though they are academically qualified. It must be given, throughout the essay I've sounded a recurrent two-part theme. The market needs a place, and the market needs to be kept in its place. It must be given enough scope to accomplish the many things it does well. It limits the power of the bureaucracy and helps to protect our freedoms against transgressions by the state. Most important, the prizes in the marketplace provide the incentives for a work and productive contribution. He hits incentives as an essential ingredient all the way through. For such a reason, I cheered the market, but I could not give it more than two cheers. The tyranny of the dollar yardstick restrains my enthusiasm. Given the chance, it would sweep away all other values and establish a vending machine society. The rights and powers that money should not buy must be protected with detailed regulations and sanctions and countervailing aids to those with low incomes. Is that, do you want to make a comment about it, Dave?
Yeah, that's great. and I think all the village is a place where you dream those kinds of dreams. Help us in considering some of the options in the workaday world.
Let me ask a question here. One of the things that shocked me in this, I keep using the word shock in this paragraph, I guess. The top fifth of families, this is in a very recent, this is in a survey within the last two and a half years, the top fifth of families have incomes above $18,000. At a disposable income of about $28,000, a family got into the top 5% of the income pyramid. Most people at that level consider themselves middle income. This is $28,000, disposable income. Most people at that level consider themselves middle income rather than upper income, and are shocked to learn that their incomes exceed those of 19 out of 20 American families. He also has a number of other things which comes home to me in reference to a course I'm going to teach in the fall on 19th century art. The first part of the course, we're discussing the French Revolution, and the major cause of it is that 5% of the people owned 95% of all the wealth, all the assets of France in the last couple of decades of the 19th century. And that fantastically top-heavy society collapsed into the French Revolution. The portion of the income of the very affluent, in excess of...
Talleyrand said how sweet it was.
Yeah, that's right. And finished, yeah. The very affluent excess of $50,000 per household amounts to only about 2% of the total disposable income. That seems reassuring, he said. On the other hand, the top 1% of the families have as much after-tax income as nearly all the families in the bottom fifth of our nation. That's
very disturbing. If our society goes ahead and operates in the same way that it does now, you could take every bit of wealth from the upper income families, redistribute it to all the rest of us, and inside of 6 months it would be back in the same place.
His primary category is not wealth, however, it is income. And so it's continual redistribution that he's after, and not a matter of accumulation. I think he might agree with you, but it would be it's a matter of income, redistribution of income. So that, for example, one thing he concretely proposes, in order to make up for the problem of lower income people going to school, where he's got the statistics here in terms of where you got the same ability, and so the top half to the bottom half for the males is 29 to 62%. That is 29% of the lower income group compared with the same ability as the as others in the top would go to college is over against 62. And so what he's proposing is something Yale has done, is to loan money on a percentage return, so that you pay a percentage of the amount you earn after you graduate for a number of years, I take it. I don't know the exact term, but you see what he's after is all kinds of things which will overcome what he considers to be inequalities that are not due to effort, not due to anything except what history has provided you in the way of background, the kind of family you grow up in, the kind of opportunities, I don't know how you overcome the cultural stimulation that differs in a lower class family from a middle class family, all the kinds of things that are available.
This was proposed at Yale about 3 years ago. Anybody here from Yale that could tell us what's happened? That the scholarships that they would give would be loaned on the basis that a percentage of income earned after graduation would be returned to pay for it. So if you went into a very high bracket a number of years after graduation, you'd be paying back a lot of money, perhaps more than you earned, more than you had borrowed. But the point being that wouldn't affect you very much. On the other hand, if you got clobbered and were not able to earn a large amount after graduation, the percentage of what you earned would be, in absolute figures, very small, and therefore that would not damage you. I do not know, that started about 3 years ago at Yale. I do not know what's going on with it today.
It's interesting that this figure comes out. I've got a kid who's college bound, and I did a little investigating, and I found out very quickly that almost without exception, all of the assistance in college is lower income. And then another figure that comes to mind is the student loan program guaranteed by the government has outstanding, I believe, $6.5 billion loaned to students on their own signature, much of which is not being paid.
Headlines in a paper today, I noticed that the government has just passed some laws tightening up the recovery of default loans that defaulted by students.
But there, the whole, evidently the whole thrust of available scholarships is largely based on economic need, and in addition, the government has done a tremendous amount to subsidize.
That's true.
Our question is whether that's good and right. I think he's really pushing for a welfare system that will have a kind of negative income tax effect. And of course, there's several plans that have been before Congress to do this, which would really guarantee a floor of income and then guarantee a certain percentage of what people earn. So the incentive would be there. And he's got some figures in here, and I guess we could throw figures around forever. But one of the questions is, whatever the level, do we really believe that income ought to be transferred really from those who have a lot of income to those who don't have a lot of income in one way or another?
How would they be transferred? How would you go about transferring?
By negative income tax. That is, if you only earn $4,000 in your, let's say you only earn $3,000 and the level is $4,000, if you turn in your income tax of $3,000, they send you a check for $1,000.
Would this destroy incentive above the $4,000 category?
Well, his theory is that you will then tax away again a certain percentage of earned income, and therefore, let us say you earned, you had the $4,000 ceiling, and you earned $3,000, you're guaranteed four. In his proposal, you'd get 50% of that 3,000. So you'd get your, you'd get the four plus the 50% of 3,000. You'd get more money, you see. And they're working this out. It's a matter of arithmetic and figuring out how much it costs and so forth. His point is that with the national budget and with the GNP the way it is, we can really afford to pay a little to give a floor to our people. Really afford it. And he thinks we should. In other words, he thinks equality, the principle of equality, demands that we really provide a floor.
I know, just as an illustration, and by the way, this is what I'm saying as a generalization, that the major factor, I think, was the congregations and pastors which were not successful. And I use that word with trepidation, because, you know, Christ's crucifixion on the cross.
And he thinks we should. In other words, he thinks equality, the principle of equality, demands that we really provide a floor. Now, one of the questions is how big the floor is. One of the questions is, in principle, what about the floor in terms of incentive?
I thought one of his more persuasive points was in connection with this, making sure that the top students had an opportunity to go to college. I've read that one of the best investments that the federal government ever made was in providing the GI Bill for the veterans. That the increased income as a result of those stipends has been returned in additional income taxes many times over.
The difference between the GI Bill and what he proposes, though, as I recall the bill, having gone all the way through 5 years of college on it, was that it had nothing to do with my talents at all once I could get into the school. So therefore, it's not a matter of being a top ability man guaranteed, but that everybody, in this instance, everybody who qualified to get the GI Bill could go if he could get accepted into a college. So we're not talking about top students. His top student emphasis smacks of the efficiency thing again, because he's going to do the one that's going to be more efficient to create. Yeah.
No, he is really concerned about equality of political rights. We've got the market, but we've also got rights, and he doesn't think political rights are equal. And again, it's partly because of money, or largely because of money, in terms of the way we've allowed people to buy into the political system, and it's like Common Cause in a way. He wants to open up the political system and get funds available that don't come from corporate enterprises or wealthy families. He wants to open up the process so that there isn't a control of the political process by economic, by wealth, really. That's as I understand what he's about. And
you get into a real obvious trap there, too, which you can see, that if you take a position of representative or state legislature, and you make it with a nominal salary, then you're liable to attract people of wealth who can afford to be a state senator. And you say, well, that's easy to fix. We'll raise the salary of a state senator high enough so that you can afford to go without necessarily being independently wealthy. And then you immediately attract people of mediocre skills who want the job only for the salary and are not necessarily have the skill to handle it wisely. And that's a trap. If you look, you see over and over again, as you raise the salary of public servants, you attract mediocre people who could not anywhere near approach that salary on a more competitive job, but have the ability to gain the job and keep it.
So the alternatives for the federal government to provide the funds for the campaign, so you're not beholden to anybody for your campaigns. I mean, that's one proposal. We know that's a proposal, and we know it's being tried in part. And
Getting the job is not necessarily just a matter of funds. The best qualified guy.
But the question is, how is? Yeah, of course, there are all kinds of other favors that are involved in.
Mr. Nixon got in
Campaign funds are a real problem, aren't they? I mean, it really takes a lot of money to mount a campaign. Well, let me raise a question. Nowhere in this book does he mention the rest of the world. And the rest of the world hasn't entered into our discussion tonight. What's he talking about? Equality of Americans. Equality of our citizens. Second question, just to keep you thinking. Nowhere does he talk about the quality of life. He assumes if you have an efficient system, if you have a rising GNP, that everything is good, except for equality. But equality of what? Equality of whatever there is to be had, in my favorite expression. Now, can we really stop with these two notions as standards for our national life? That is, equality for Americans within our system, and efficiency measured in terms of our GNP.
Well, of course, the most popular book of Barbara Ward, the woman that Rudy met, the birth up there is Spaceship Earth. You know that phrase. Spaceship Earth means we're all passengers here together. That's what you're getting at, isn't it, Al?
Well, I not quite we're all passengers here together. I guess we are all passengers here together, but I had a kind of notion that somehow our Christian faith took us into some relationship other than being passengers, that we had a certain kind of responsibility in our freedom to care for other people. And there's not one word, is there? Not one word in this book. This was the chairman of the Council of what? Economic Advisors for Johnson. This is a senior fellow of Brookings Institute. This is the kind of mentality that is shaping our whole national life.
But he's not addressing himself to the theological or philosophic question. He's addressing himself to an economic question in an economic context.
That's true, but the question is, can this be done? That is true. He says in a small parenthesis someplace early about these are some other questions, and he doesn't talk about quality or the other worlds. But he does speak about some things more involved with what we're talking about, and he says in parenthesis, "But I'm not going to talk about those." That does not mean that that therefore a discussion of the GNP and efficiency can be done without talking about those. Even if he says he's not going to talk about them, that's what Al's asking.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's any economic question that isn't a theological question.
Wow.
I really don't.
The economic question we're having about the complexity of income tax return, how are we going to relate that to a theological question?
Well, how do you make your decision about what you do? On what grounds? On what conception of what a human being is? And what your responsibility for him is? And what opportunities ought to be provided for a child of God.
Okay. Income tax is the mechanism for deciding.
Technical questions involved, but I don't see how you in the last resort make any technical decision. I think that's one of the problems in America, is we've become a land of means, and we can go through our whole lives in some sense without asking that question about what is it all for. Why the big GNP?
Well, the why the big GNP? So you touched on it. What are our responsibilities to the rest of the world? If you don't produce the wheat, which is part of GNP, you can't feed starving nations overseas. That's the simplest. If you don't have a big GNP and have capital formation to support drug companies so they can build new penicillin plants, you don't have penicillin to export overseas to stop an epidemic.
So we're going to spend $650 billion for electrical power plants between now and 1985, in order to, and it's a very low labor intensive industry. When we could consume half that much energy, we're going to do all those things without asking the questions about why or whether we need all that energy or whether they need the things that take all that energy.
Okay, well, I'm answering the question, is GNP as an objective worthwhile? And you're saying, okay, but let's direct it.
Okay, it's ambiguous.
I'll totally buy that if you say, hey.
It's ambiguous.
Yeah, if you say, if you say to me that the energy we're going to consume is going to allow us to build farm machinery to help feed the world, we might agree yes. If you say the plants we're going to build is going to increase the light power and let us have extra lights and bigger rooms and brighter TVs, I would agree. Maybe this is not worthwhile. So you have to get down to not arguing with GNP, but what are you going to do with the GNP? How are you going to consume the benefits of it?
That question seems not to be one that's raised.
Yes.
Well, I guess I have a question whether we really believe in equality at home. And I guess I think we don't believe in equality for the world. I know very few people who believe in equality for the world.
What do you mean by equality for the world?
Well, namely that the principle of equality ought to be applied like he once applied it to America. It ought to be one of the things we always ask. Whether we can't help the world become more equal to us in terms of income per capita, let's just take that, half the world, $200 a head, income per capita, whether we don't have to ask the question, can we not maintain our efficiency in some way and push for more equality in the rest of the world? And the rest of the world, I just happen to have something here that Marlene gave me this morning. You know, it's one of those things by Nyerere, who's talking about the fact that all of the industrial companies had outside capital in order to grow. And the question is, how can the developing countries develop at all without outside capital? Now, that's an economic question. I'm only raising a principle. Do we raise the question in asking about equality whether or not, when we think about our system and what it's doing, do we ask the question, to what extent does it contribute by virtue of what we're doing to the equality in the world? Or do we just hope it works that way? Do we really raise that question seriously?
I hope I don't sound like I'm continuing all of Herbert Spencer, but it's very hard to be deeply concerned about the poor here at home when most of them seem so quiet. And it's very hard to be concerned about the poor abroad when many of them are not endangering us by great threats. What's happened and historically is that, as Queen Elizabeth said when she came over here on July the 4th and gave that speech, she said, we realize how ignorant and deaf we had been to the concerns of the colonials, and we learned something when the Americans shot at us after 1776 and so forth. So Al, the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King, I won't go into that much, but the whole civil rights movement, even though Martin Luther King said peace and so forth, everybody knew that there was a threat of violence in that whole thing, and there's a threat of bloodshed that was involved there, and sometimes bloodshed did break out just a little bit. But the blacks have made marvelous strides because they made really loud noises. You know the old phrase, the wheel that does the squeaking is the one that gets the grease. Right now, it's true that sometimes poor people in the world are so numb and defeated that they can't protest. For example, some of you heard me say more than once, I was obsessed with this book on the Irish famines, 1847-49, that I read recently. There was no armed revolution in Ireland with all those people starving, partly because they were just so numb and defeated. But our poor here are not that defeated, and they're just simply not making very many noises for various reasons, which some of you have expressed. So the Arabs have this neat deal of the oil that makes us listen, and the others are learning from the Arabs. And I don't see, Al, that we're just going to just absolutely deplete our treasury by 10 or 15% and give it to a very quiet people. We'll give it to those people when they are noisy, military, clever, scheming, blackmailing, and other things. No nation gives away its wealth just for Christian charity.
We have been since World War II, though.
Oh, but that's not... I knew you were going to say that. But I've planned an answer ahead of time. The one reason we've given away our wealth is because of the real and imaginary communism around the world. And all Christians should, in a sense, give one withered rose on the grave of Karl Marx, because John Foster Dulles and those other anti-communist maniacs gave away a lot of our wealth because they thought it would curtail the communists. As a matter of fact, our threat of communism is both real and imaginary. And we gave away most of that wealth, arms, and aid because of communism. Even the Marshall Plan, one of our few successful ventures, is that we did not want Europe to go the route of the Nazis in 1933. So the Nazis and the communists made us do it, not Christian charity. We do hardly anything from Christianity, but we do a lot from our fears.
I don't think we even think of equality in our own country yet, though. You know, you ask if we thought about it for the world. I don't think we've reached that point, because they are a quiet majority. The poor are suffering. And I think when we lived in Houston, there was a criminal lawyer by the name of Percy Foreman who went around representing very rich people. And he once said, my clients don't pay me in order to get justice. My clients pay me so that I can get their freedom, and that's what I get. And then he said, the only place where justice comes in is when I send my bill. And, you know, I think of that very often when I see the amount of poor people that are in jail compared to the amount of rich people. When this study came out again on the Supreme Court, capital punishment, and they went around seeing who was still on death row, most of the people were poor or black or something else. It wasn't the rich people who were sitting there.
Are you then proposing that we ought not to answer Al's question with a yes, because we've got too many other problems at home?
No, I think we should think both. But I think that maybe one of the reasons that we don't face it internationally is because we don't have enough guts to face it nationally.
We don't have enough what?
Guts.
Guts. That's their word, visceral, again. Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. No. That's a private joke. I apologize for that.
Okay. You mean we should say we don't have enough viscera?
No, that's awful.
I think that when we face it, if we honestly face it...
You're answering his question with no, we don't want to because we haven't faced it
right.
yet.
And I think that if we do have the intestinal fortitude to face it, we have to get involved. And that's terribly risky. And sometimes even as Christians, we don't want to take that risk. Because if we know that there's injustice, then we should do something about it. So it's better to pretend it doesn't exist than to try to get involved with it.
Now, would it be possible to identify, if we don't do it because the risk is too great, what about identifying the risk of not doing it being as great as? I mean, if risk is the reason, the fear, if the fear that comes to us from the risk is what prevents us from this kind of action, it seems to me we haven't even examined the risk, because the risk of not doing it might in fact be greater than the risk of doing it.
Well, I think we could bring that even closer down to the church. Look at many of our inner city churches. The people, as soon as the neighborhood started to change, anybody who could afford to left. And we're in a congregation where that's happened right now. And it left you not just financially unable to minister, but it left you with no leadership to minister. And the people who stayed were either very old, who no longer chose to move out of the area, or who were very poor and couldn't move out of the area. And the people who could have served in that congregation said, for one reason or the other, it's no longer like my church. After all these people aren't even the same color as I am anymore, you know. It's not like when I came here in 1908 or something. So, I mean, I think in the church we even find that, you know, that we aren't willing to get that involved. And that hurts in the church.
I think the answer to your question is it's a matter of immediacy, which is the most immediate question. And we operate pretty much on the threat that's greatest
whether it really is or not, is the one that's most immediate. And the threat that you're talking about not doing this is more in the future, or less immediate, less threatening.
It'd be interesting to know, though, the answer to that, whether or not, in fact, if we aren't cutting our own throats by not attesting to the problems of equality. It wasn't so many years ago that some of our cities were burning, and maybe some of our businesses that some people own. And to assume that that Irish people will never rebel is an assumption.
Well, yeah, they did.
May not be.
They did.
Historical context, as they know better today, they hear better.
Yeah.
They see more, and whether or not they will simply sit there is an interesting. I personally think there is a tremendous risk, and I don't feel so badly for those of us who know better. I think it's a shame though that our children will probably have to
answer the question that we're not asking. Yeah.
Maybe. And the sins of the fathers will fall elsewhere.
Someone has said, can we ignore any nation now that we have the atomic bomb?
More enemies?
I mean, yes, any nation that would be our enemies or could be or possibly could be. Is that changed the picture for us, in other words, now that we do, that the atomic bomb has become relevant in a lot of countries?
Well, one of the enemies might be the atomic bomb.
It's interesting that those of us who claim to be free in the gospel, that what Jim was talking about tonight, talk about fear and risk of being attacked and undermined, and that's a motivation that we talk about. And that I think, you know, the author of this book, who doesn't profess to be a Christian, would agree with you. That's all we can count on. He's got a nice paragraph here that I thought was the key to his position. He says, races or dances, efforts to promote equality of opportunity accept an individualistic, achievement-oriented, and exceptionally competitive economy in which prizes will be given and a variety of hierarchies will continue to exist. On the other hand, some see the contests of modern society as dehumanizing rat races, and their objective is not to make them fair, but to eliminate them. They want fewer races and more dances that feature cooperation and fraternity. Male chauvinist. It may well be desirable to effect some shift in the mixture of competition and cooperation, but a major de-emphasis of competition means foregoing individualistic incentives, and that in turn involves either a tremendous sacrifice of efficiency or else the creation of alternative incentive systems. Perhaps people will work and produce in order to serve humanity, guided by a love for all mankind as brothers and sisters. But it remains to be demonstrated that such a spirit can motivate common mortals and not merely saints. Properly indoctrinated, people can be induced to work for the greater glory of the state or of the leader of the state, reflecting traditional values, however. Most Americans would rather run races for their own prizes than run errands for their leader's glory. Most, I'm going to paraphrase that now after the sermon tonight. Most Americans would prefer to do as they please rather than to run errands that reflect their having been called by God to love. I mean, I just think that's what he's saying. And our conversation, I don't mean to be pessimistic about it. Our conversation reflects the fact that we don't expect Christians to be Christian, right? We really don't expect that. We don't think we can, either there's so few Christians, in spite of the millions and millions who are in our churches, or we don't expect of ourselves to take seriously this call. Or somehow we think this system is the way we love. I mean, it's either one of those things.
I don't think it's quite that simple or pure.
I agree.
Yeah. No, know, you're really saying, and I'm sure I can't quote it, but you're really saying, you know, give up all your wealth and follow me just out of love.
No, I didn't say that.
No, but I this is implicit in what you're saying. Hey, let's cooperate out of love and Christianity. And I can't argue with the premise, except I will go along with what you said, that is so far from reality of what any of us experience, and to make the gap from where we are to that kind of a society is interesting to contemplate, but unrealistic to embrace.
But didn't the rich young ruler sort of say the same thing?
Did what?
Didn't the rich young ruler sort of say the same thing to Jesus when he said to, you know, give up all he had? And he said, no, I'm not sure I can do that. Isn't that part of what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying that it's interesting to contemplate, but it's unreal in terms of any of our experiences.
Well, I think our movement toward equality in this country has been very real. And I think it comes out of some genuine interest in the bottom half or the bottom quarter of the people in terms of social services.
Yeah, but I don't think we're saying the same thing. I think I was addressing myself to the problem of give up the race, the incentive of reward, and in exchange substitute Christian love and charity. We will all do our best and utmost, and then of course you've got to say, well, really, how are we going to be rewarded, which gets dangerous. But let's all do it out of Christian charity and love, and I think that's a different than the progress that's been made on equality. How would you reward the first and second car, or would you not have any cars because we can't all have cars? How would you do it?
Put tax.
Well, we're already doing that.
Well, even more so. So I understand Canada is going to do it.
Higher taxes.
You've got funds for research, agriculture research. According to my authority, if you had $1 billion a year for 10 years to establish regional research centers for agriculture, if you had that $10 billion for 10 years and $500 million for the next 10 years, you could begin to develop the kind of agricultural knowledge that's relevant. Much of ours isn't relevant, but it's relevant to the developing areas. It would help them take care of their food. That's only one illustration. And what that means is our national policy to provide that $1 billion a year. I mean, it's that kind of thing, it seems to me, very concrete social policy that we could support if enough of the people believed in this kind of activity. It isn't simple to figure out the technical ways, but there are things to do.
I'm sorry I missed that talk on India this morning. Maybe they addressed it. But India was on the road to self-sufficiency in agriculture, and then politically it changed. And the incentive to own your own farm and produce as much as you can for your own purposes was eliminated, and therefore India is now back in the slough of despond. And you're supposed to be trying to help pull them out. So if we develop the technology, they have to adopt it themselves and feel it's their own. We can't impose it politically on other countries.
Well, Nyerere here is in his speech is certainly willing. He, you know, as a matter of fact, we didn't finance that railroad that they wanted to put through the Zambia, and the Chinese did. The Chinese sent what? I don't know, 15,000 people over to work on it. They just sent them over, and they sent produce and stuff with them. They sent the supplies and all this stuff and did it for them. Now, that's the kind of thing Nyerere is talking about. Now, we have a problem, of course, helping anybody who's as far to the left as Nyerere is, probably. That's what Jim was talking about. We're really afraid of that. And if you look at China, for example, China solved the problem in a different way. I'm not advocating one way or the other, but there are ways, and the question is, whether we try to help people who are trying to help themselves. I don't have any formula, but I think it's interesting that when we talk about equality, and when this author talks about equality, we don't raise the question about whether equality is meaningful in the world. And I'd really like to push it even further to suggest, is it conceivable that the standard of living that we have could be universalized? Maybe it could be.
There was a cartoon in Atlas from a foreign publication that I glanced at the other day showing the Great Wall of China. And south of that wall, it was one vast junkyard that said, what if every Chinese had an automobile? There is that.
We need 800 million automobiles.
I think one reason that we can't think in terms, or that we don't know what Christian is, one thing that shows that we're not thinking in terms of world equality, and then to relate to your statement, could we all live on the whole world live on the level that of the economy that we have now, goes back to the question that was asked earlier, or just the wording of the question was asked earlier, could the whole world, could there be equality, equal status of living throughout the world? But it wasn't, I can't remember the wording though, but it wasn't like an equal standard. It said, could they all be equal to us?
Yeah,
the question was asked in that terms. It wasn't
that's equality, what I asked
but
it,
equal
yeah.
to us.
Because yeah. I think that raises the question of quality. Lynn, I think that's really a good question. Because, you know, you're picking up, it raised the question of the quality of our lives.